remember a thing. I just woke up and there I was. No pulse, no breath. I need to know, Jane. Does it hurt? To die, I mean. Does it hurt? Did she suffer? His eyes pinned me, tears slipping down his cheeks. No. It's just like falling asleep, I told him, tucking his hair behind his ear and giving him a sisterly kiss on the cheek. It doesn't hurt at all. I'm going to stay here for a few days, if that's okay, Dick said. I don't want to move her again. You're more than welcome, I said. I'll lay out some sheets and some towels for you. I pushed away from the counter to do just that, but my arms and legs were suddenly so tired. I stumbled against the kitchen table and felt Gabriel's hands on my arm steadying me. Sorry. I think the blood loss and head injuries are catching up with me. I can take care of myself, Stretch, Dick said. Gabe, take her upstairs and make her get some sleep. I don't care what you have to do to convince her. I just don't want to hear anything. I smiled at the half-hearted insinuation. To joke about my sex life, Dick must be feeling a little better. I let Gabriel lift me bridal style and carry me up the stairs. Now it was my turn to be undressed and tucked into bed. When he slid under the sheets behind me, pulling me to his chest, I turned to him and buried my face against his skin. I lied, I told Gabriel, wiping at my eyes. When I said it doesn't hurt to die, I lied. It's agony. It was like drowning on dry land, being crushed, not being able to breathe. It hurts, but I couldn't tell Dick that. I lied. I know, sweetheart, he said, brushing his lips along my brow. I remember. Even without the added pain of being shot, taking that last breath, it hurts. But sometimes we have to lie to protect the ones we love. I narrowed my eyes at him. He cleared his throat. Though, obviously, I will never be doing that again. But you did the right thing. How will this affect Dick? I asked him. Will it be weird for him to be with a vampire he hasn't sired? He shrugged. It's not a requirement. There are lots of vampires in very successful relationships. Are they going to be okay or not? It's a violation, Gabriel agreed. Dick will be reminded of it every day. He'll feel he failed her somehow, that he didn't protect her. But he loves her. He will set it all aside to be with her. It seems my life is just as uncertain and out of control as when I was human. I thought I'd changed, learned. I thought I was more in control. I'm scared of what's to come, what I don't understand yet. I closed my eyes as Gabriel murmured, Jane, you can't worry about the future so much that you miss out on the present. And I'll be with you, no matter what. I slept that deep sleep that requires that you wake up with a patch of drool drying on your face. Vaguely, I remembered falling asleep with Gabriel, waking at one point when it was dark outside, and finding him awake next to me. I was hungry, but far too tired to leave the bed, so he held his wrist to my lips and let me drink from him. There were a few more sleepy patches in which I woke, fed, and went back to sleep. But now I was just confused and had serious bed hair. What time is it? I asked, squinting in the twilight. Gabriel stroked a thumb down my temple where the flesh was smooth and unmarred now. 6 p.m. on Thursday. I bolted out of bed. Holy crap! I slept for 3 days? You were exhausted, he said, and you had a lot of healing to do. Andrea? I asked, slipping into some clean jeans. Rose late last night, he said, smiling. She was ravenous. She went through your entire supply of synthetic blood and the Hershey syrup. Dick says he owes you. I think I'll let it slide this once, I snorted. Just pry Dick off of my couch before tomorrow morning. I don't want him getting too comfortable. Gabriel followed, laughing, as I tore out of bed and down the stairs. Andrea was standing in my living room, balancing my coffee table on one hand. There was a huge grin on her pale, angelic face. Dick looked like a human who'd been staring at the sun for too long, dazzled and dazed. I launched myself at her, knocking the table right onto Dick's head as I hugged her. Dick was smiling, even as he threw the wreckage over his shoulder. "Hey!" She giggled, punching me on the arm. Gabriel, who had followed at a less frantic pace, snickered at Andrea's display of newfound strength. "Ow!" I rubbed my arm and glared at her. "I don't think I'm going to like you having super strength, or being all giddy. It's disconcerting."
"Don't be sorry," she said. "I mean, let's be honest. My entire life was leading to this. I'm lucky it didn't happen long before. Of course, I would have much rather that you or Dick turned me when I had, you know, a choice in the matter. But when I think about it, what was I staying human for anyway? Emery made the choice I should have made a while ago. My family doesn't speak to me. Everyone I love is going to live forever. And how would my relationship with Dick work out in the long term without a change?"
"You're really okay with this?" I asked, giving her a long, appraising look. She'd been merely beautiful in life. She was stunning now. Her skin was a perfect, creamy pearl color that set off the fiery red of her hair. Her lips were soft and pink and full, curving over glistening white teeth. I searched her face for some sign of regret, of sorrow, but found nothing. There was a new exuberance to Andrea. It was as if she'd finally figured out what she'd been missing all these years. Fangs. "Because I had some adjustment issues that you don't seem to be having." Andrea shuddered delicately.
"Well, the blood thing is gross. Even after spending so much time with you, I have to admit it's weird drinking it myself. But look at all the pros. I can climb walls and lift tables, and frankly, my ass has never looked better."
"Ew."
"I'm looking forward to eternity, Jane," she said, sliding onto Dick's lap. "Besides, at least now, vampires won't see me as a snack."
"I never saw you as a snack, baby doll," Dick chuckled, kissing her neck.
"I love you so much," she cooed, crushing him to her.
"Me too, honey. Me too."
Dick stroked his fingers over Andrea's. I noticed that she was wearing the little ruby engagement ring he'd shown me on Halloween night. I felt a rush of relief for both of them. Emery may have turned Andrea, but Dick had marked her forever. She was his. It was that simple, and I felt sorry for whoever said otherwise. But instead of giving voice to these emotionally mature thoughts, I took the disgusted teenager route. I groaned. "Ugh, are you two going to go through some sort of gross honeymoon phase? Because you're going to have to do that somewhere else."
"Maybe we should consider another trip," Gabriel suggested. "The southern hemisphere should be far enough away."
"Oh, calm down, both of you," Andrea said, smirking. "You might as well get used to it."
"Remind me to write a PDA in the workplace policy for the shop," I muttered to Gabriel.
"Now that all the newborn angst is settled," Andrea shot me a stern look, "can we talk about why you don't need a stun gun?"
I put up my hands in a defensive stance. "Okay, in hindsight, it was not my wisest purchase." Chapter 17. Love is about facing fear. The fear of rejection, the fear of intimacy, the fear of being hurt. With vampire relationships, the fear quotient tends to be a little higher. Love Bites, A Female Vampire's Guide to Less Destructive Relationships. When Gabriel helped me out of his car, I fussed with his tie, straightening the blue-gray silk before giving his bottom lip a nipping kiss.
"What was that for?"
he asked. I kissed him again and adjusted the straps of my own blood-red silk party dress. "For guaranteeing that I will no longer be remembered as plain Jane by my classmates."
"Why do I get the feeling that I'm being used for my pretty face?"
he asked as we passed under a white and blue balloon arch and a banner that read, "Welcome back, Howlers, class of 1998.
"Hush up, arm candy," I muttered.
Half Moon Hollow High School's gym smelled exactly the same, like B.O. and anxiety. The reunion committee had tried valiantly to transform the gym into an enchanted paradise, using the same props they used at our prom 10 years before. Let's see. Transparent plastic palm trees lined with twinkle lights? Check. Giant paper mache volcano with fake flame streamers blowing out? Check.
giant parachute billowing artfully from the ceiling to give the impression that we were extremely well-dressed castaways under an impromptu shelter? Check. Ignoring the fact that said parachute's storage closet was rumored to be the conception site of Coach Kelly's love child with Mindy Noonan? Check.
This is a rite of passage? Gabriel asked, eyeing the faux volcano. What exactly does this signify?
Nothing. Let's go, I said, turning on my heel and making what would have been a brilliant dash for the door if Gabriel hadn't caught my arm.
We agreed this was an important part of your emotional development.
When did we agree to that? I demanded as he dragged me toward the registration table.
You said it. I agreed to it. It's similar to a verbal contract.
You're not a nice man, I told him.
I think we've established that,
he said, as he planted me firmly in front of the table, where a brunette in a cantaloupe-colored suit turned to me with pasted-on smile. I searched her face. Huh. I was expecting to be confronted with someone who'd tortured me in the cafeteria or mocked me in math, but I had no idea who this person was.
Jane! She cried. It's so good to see you.
Hey! I zeroed in on her name tag. I didn't even recognize the little senior photo that was laminated next to her name. Like so many of us who graduated from HHHS in the 1990s, she suffered from poofy bangs combined with the horrid plaid flannel of the grunge period. Pop culture influence had only so much sway over hollow girls. We could not be persuaded to put away our curling irons. I scanned the name. Mary Beth, how are you?
Oh, you know me!
She chuckled as she handed me my name tag. I winced because, no, I didn't.
I'm always busy. I'm just so glad to see you here. You look great. And who is this?
This is my boyfriend, Gabriel, I said as she scribbled out a guest name tag with a Sharpie. Mary Beth winked broadly at him.
Well, you better watch her, Gabriel. She was always one of the sassiest girls in the class.
Not much has changed, Gabriel informed her.
I can't wait to find the two of you later so we can catch up, she cooed.
See? That woman seemed very happy that you're here, he said as we walked away. She said you were sassy and seemed to think it was a good thing.
I have no idea who that woman is, I told him.
It still counts.
So that's what you looked like in high school?
He asked, staring at the tiny yearbook photo embossed on my name tag. I pinched his arm. I went through an unfortunate hair era. Don't judge me. You used to wear stockings.
They were in fashion at the time, he protested.
So were the permed bangs. Thank God for cruel college girls and a roommate who read Cosmo. He snorted. I hadn't seen most of my classmates in a while. Some of them had actually managed to escape the hollow and establish life on the outside. And the ones who did live in town had daytime schedules, so our paths didn't cross often. Everybody looked smaller. Not weight-wise, because a few people had packed on some pounds, but somehow I remember these people as giants, looming over me. Most of them were smiling, making polite conversation, and the social boundaries that had defined us 10 years ago seemed to have melted away. The former jocks were mixing with the AV club. The homecoming queen had an affectionate arm around the softball captain. We ambled past a display of photos, surrounded by white votive candles. In glittery silver letters, it said, "We remember fondly."
"I'm on the memorial board," I gasped. "I thought I took care of that. I RSVP'd, for goodness sake. Dead people don't RSVP."
"Well, at least they remembered you fondly,"
Gabriel said, trying to find a silver lining.
"Gah," I huffed. "It says fondly," he said again.
"Oh, Jane, it's so nice to see you back from the dead,"
I heard Jolene drawl from behind me. Jolene was dressed in a simple, sleeveless red dress, backlit by the low votives on the tables. Even with a baby tucked in her arms, her hotness was undeniable. She was smirking, obviously enjoying the premature reports of my demise. "You brought the kids?" I asked, taking Janelyn from her.
"Zeb sort of insisted on it," she said, rolling her eyes.
She nodded to where Zeb stood with Joe, surrounded by girls who wouldn't have given him the time of day in school. They were all cooing and making funny faces at the baby. I couldn't help but think he was trying to show them what they had missed by turning him down as a prom date.
Something about proving to the jerks from Woodshop that his boys swim, and we weren't the only ones.
She gestured to several other couples bouncing uncomfortable-looking babies in their Sunday best. I scoffed. Well, the twins are obviously the best-looking babies here. She smiled adoringly at Jane Lynn.
Obviously.
Having a good time? I asked a grinning Zeb as he hefted the baby on one hip.
This is awesome,
he cried, as another group of women flocked around his beautiful children, cooing and awing. He handed Joe to me, taking Jolene's arm and dragging her toward Adam Morrow, Rick Mullen, and most of the former baseball team.
I think some of the guys over there haven't seen Jolene yet.
Adam spotted me from across the room, and a smile lit up his perfect, even features. He straightened his tie and was two steps toward me when Gabriel slid his arm around my waist and commented on how fetching I looked with babies in my arms. Adam blanched, seeming to size Gabriel up in one long look, and took two steps back toward safety. I snickered.
What's funny?
Gabriel asked. I considered telling him, but I remembered Gabriel had threatened to literally put a boot up Adam's ass the previous year. I didn't think an introduction would go over very well.
Not a thing.
Here, can you take one? I said awkwardly, shifting both babies in my arms.
I don't think I'm qualified.
Okay, then. Gabriel grimaced as I tucked Jane Lynn into the crook of his elbow. He looked into her little face and cleared his throat.
How do you do?
He seemed offended when I laughed at him.
I've never held a baby before. It's not something men did in my time, even if they were your own.
No, you're doing beautifully, I promised, kissing him.
Hey, cut that out. There are impressionable children present, Dick said, taking Joe from my arms and making silly faces.
Joe, who thought Dick was the funniest person alive, in his limited worldview, gurgled hysterically. Dick had been in high spirits for the last week or so. With Andrea's almost seamless transition into vampirism and his renewed friendship with Gabriel, the only thorn in his side was Emery's sentencing. Of course, Ophelia had lifted that burden a few days before when she arrived at the shop looking for a copy of the latest Michelle Bardsley novel. Dick had asked her what the council had decided to do with Emery. She gave him a razor-thin smile and said, "There is no Emery." And then she flounced out of the shop in her usual unsettling manner. Knowing that Emery had suffered hideously at the hands of the council had given Dick and Andrea some measure of closure. Dick and Mr. Wainwright mourned the end of their bloodline, but, given Emery's example, agreed it was probably for the best.
"I don't think you qualify as impressionable anymore, Dick," Gabriel said dryly. "But the child label certainly fits."
Dick responded with a hand gesture that was also inappropriate for underage viewing. "What are you doing here?" I asked. Dick had a tag on his chest declaring that he was Martin Gruber, president of the chess club and the Latin Society. Even in the short-sleeved plaid shirt and Clark Kent glasses, complete with white tape around the nosepiece, Dick looked nothing like poor, gangly, bespectacled Martin.
"And what are you going to do if Martin actually shows up?" "Claim identity theft. There was no way I was going to miss this," Dick snickered. "Zeb said there was a distinct possibility you might freak out and smack some people around, maybe even a cheerleader. You know how I love it when you do that."
I rolled my eyes and focused on Jane Lynn, who was spitting up on Gabriel's jacket. The twins giggled and drooled, oblivious to the fact that they were surrounded by monsters. Seriously, werewolves on one side of the family, vampires on the other. What were these kids going to be afraid of?
"There's always clowns," I muttered to myself, shuddering.
Jolene swooped in as I struggled to keep Jane Lynn still and mop up the mess on Gabriel's shoulder.
"Something's leaking from somewhere," I said, holding Jane Lynn at arm's length as she dribbled from her tiny rosebud mouth.
"Come here, baby,"
Jolene cooed, tucking the baby into her arms and producing a wet wipe from her purse.
"That is the best part. I can give them back," I told Gabriel quietly.
Gabriel asked,
"Where's Andrea?"
Dick nodded to the stunning pale redhead standing by the punch bowl, chatting with Hector Gonzalez and a girl I used to take French with. Andrea was pretending to be Dora Grady. Overweight,
Cursed with bad skin and a shock of unruly red frizz, Dora was our very own Carrie White, without the telekinetic revenge. While I didn't exactly participate in the locker room abuse of Dora, my social paralysis, my failure to do anything to help her, still haunted me years later. If anyone deserved to reemerge as slim, beautiful Andrea, it was Dora. I wondered where she was and hoped that she'd found some measure of happiness, that she wasn't here tonight because she'd decided her former classmates weren't worth her time, and that she wasn't lurking in the eaves of the gym waiting to trap us inside and kill us in a well-deserved inferno. I shook off these thoughts. Andrea was adjusting to vampire life far faster than I had. She was already used to nighttime hours. She didn't have the moral confusion I did about feeding from donors, having been in their shoes. And she and her vampire boyfriend, now fiancé, had settled most of their issues before she was turned. I could only hope that she wouldn't ask me to be a bridesmaid. I thought back to my plan for a brave new Jane. Andrea would never need one, but so far I'd made impressive headway on mine. Normal, healthy relationship? As normal and healthy as I was ever going to get, so check. Fulfilling career? Check. Loving, non-judgmental family? I'd created my own and managed to include a few blood relatives, so check. Plan for world peace? I'd get right on it. I was standing there, admiring my friend, when Gabriel tapped me on the shoulder. "Can I talk to you for a minute?" he asked, leading me away from the punch bowl, oozing infants and our friends. "Where are we going?" I asked, as we quietly left the gym and headed for the electives building. "To sneak around the campus for a little bit in the dark. Isn't this what couples do in the movies?" Gabriel asked as we passed the metal shop. "Yeah, the horror movies where loving couples are killed by maniacs wielding farm implements. Please don't tell me that after all this you're leading me to my death."
"Well, you're already dead, and I've gotten used to having you around."
I laughed. "Right back at you, sweetheart. But seriously, what are we doing out here?"
"I gave your sister a present today,"
he said, slipping his hand into mine. "You're dragging me out in the hall to tell me you gave my sister a present? This is just like my 16th birthday."
"I'm bringing you out here to tell you that I went to your sister earlier tonight and offered her the deed to my house."
I arched a brow. "You mean the deed to one of your nicer rental properties?"
"To my house on Silver Ridge Road. I asked if she would like to have it, and she accepted. Actually, I barely uttered the word deed, and she'd accepted. She'd like to move in as soon as possible."
I found that didn't bother me as much as I thought it would. Our muddy catharsis seemed to have exercised the old, almost instinctual resentments toward Jenny, though it was sort of weird to be around her now that we'd called an unofficial truce. I was so used to automatically rejecting any invitation to family gatherings that I stumbled over telling Mama that, yes, I'd come to Thanksgiving, and to tell Jenny that I'd bring my own dessert blood. When we talked, Jenny couldn't figure out where to put her hands. It was like a bad commercial audition. Also, now that she wasn't openly knocking me to Grandma Ruthie anymore, I don't think they were spending as much time together as they used to. Mama was beside herself with joy, even though I still turned down half her invitations. I said that Jenny and I had reconciled, not that I'd gone crazy.
"But that's a huge part of your family history. Why would you give it up?" I exclaimed.
Gabriel shrugged.
I've lived there for 150 years. I was getting bored with it. Besides, nobody will take better care of the place than Jenny. And I suspect she'll let your mother put the house on the Historical Society's spring tour of homes, which will indirectly cement your mother's affection for me even further."
"So you're basically homeless now?"
"No, I still have houses in..."
Gabriel caught himself.
"Yes. Yes, I am."
I crossed my arms. "So where do you plan on living?"
"Well, I was thinking I might move in with you."
"Why don't you wait to be asked?"
"Because I'd be waiting forever," he muttered.
In a very deliberate motion, he squared my shoulders in front of his and clasped my arms.
"I know I could never ask you to leave River Oaks. It means a lot more to you than my family's house means to me. Your Aunt Jetty is there. It's your home. I would like it to be my home, too. I want to make a life with you. and for most people, that means living in the same house.
Gabriel kissed me, as gentle as an angel's wing brushing across my lips.
You're my bloodmate in every sense of the word, the person I choose to spend the rest of my immortal life with, if you can stand me that long.
That's what that means? My forehead wrinkled in concentration, and I tried to remember the first time I'd heard that word. Wait, you told Missy the crazy realtor that she'd suffer dire consequences if she hurt your bloodmate. That was more than a year ago.
I knew even then. You're it for me, Jane. You're my eternity.
Well, why couldn't you have told me? I exclaimed.
Gabriel shrugged.
I wasn't ready to hear it yet. I finished for him.
I'm sorry.
But as the enormity of what Gabriel had just said sunk in, a huge grin split my face. I brought it under control so I could narrow my eyes at him.
So, you're saying you will tell me everything now. You won't try to protect me or keep me in the dark?
You'll trust me to make a rational decision about bad news after I have my inevitable initial panic attack?
He nodded solemnly.
I will.
And when I have my spastic fits of insecurity, when I make inappropriate jokes and wonder aloud why you love me, you'll understand that this has nothing to do with you but years and years of conditioning by my mother?
He smirked.
I will.
Will you agree never to accept invitations issued by my family unless you check with me first?
He nodded.
Absolutely. I giggled, throwing my arms around him and kissing him deeply.
I love you.
Wait, it's my turn, he said, cupping my face so I was locked in that bottomless gray gaze of his.
Do you promise to trust that I want to be with you and no one else? That I'm not going anywhere? Will you promise to stop trying to find problems in our relationship where there are none? To give us time to work on the problems we do have?
What problems?
Gabriel huffed out of breath. Jane.
I will, I promised.
Will you quit trying to push me away?
I will.
Will you promise never to let Dick move into our house?
I snickered.
I will.
But, there's one last thing.
Gabriel frowned.
What's that?
Can we wait on telling my mother that you're moving in? As much as she likes you, she has this thing about living in sin. The minute she finds out, the pressure for you to make an honest woman of me will start. She's already making noises about us getting engaged. I think this would just fuel her fire.
I could always propose, he suggested, kissing my cheek. Suddenly, my mouth went dry. As much as I couldn't imagine my life without Gabriel, I knew that neither one of us was ready for the rice and veil route just yet. We'd only reconciled a few weeks before. As sure as I was of his love, I needed more time before I could accept a ring from him. What can I say? I'm a contrary soul.
Thank you, but I'm not ready yet, I told him.
Gabriel tried and failed to tamp down the flash of disappointment on his face. I won't marry anyone but you, Gabriel Nightingale. But for now, let's just see if we can live together without anyone getting hurt. And the family thing, it won't be that big of a deal. It just means you can't leave any evidence of you living there lying around where my family can see it, like clothes or personal items or your car. It's just for the next few decades until, you know, they die.
Let me get this straight. You can face down psychotic vampires and legions of anal retentive entrepreneurs, but you're afraid to tell your parents that I'll be living with you before marriage?
I nodded.
Yes, that's exactly it. We'll have to talk about this,
Gabriel said dryly. But hey, between Jenny's new attitude and having you present at Christmas, I may be able to escape the holidays unscathed.
Gabriel blanched, his face even paler in the moonlight filtering through the window. Christmas? With your relatives?
I smiled, my fangs nicking my lip.
Welcome to the family, honey.
Gabriel smiled back and kissed me, long and deep.
I can live with that.
This book is over, but the story continues. Keep listening after the credits to hear the beginning of Nice Girls Don't Bite Their Neighbors, book 4 in the Jane Jameson series, Free.
This has been an Audible Inc. production of Nice Girls Don't Live Forever, written by Molly Harper and narrated by Amanda Ronconi. Executive producer, Kristen Lang. Producer, Mike Charzik. Production coordinator, Kat Lambrix. Copyright 2009 by Molly Harper White. Audio recording copyright 2009 by Audible Inc.
And now, a free preview of Nice Girls Don't Bite Their Neighbors, Book 4 in the Jane Jameson series.
Whoever said childbirth is the most difficult thing a parent can go through has never dealt with a moody teenage vampire. Siring for the Stupid, A Beginner's Guide to Raising Newborn Vampires. 3 months after he moved into my ancestral home, Gabriel Nightingale's last box was finally unpacked. The catch was that we could never break up because I had run out of friends who were willing to help us move.
"I have good news," he said, striding into the library where I was sprawled on the velvet chaise longue we'd moved into the room only a few days ago. I was reading Persuasion again, but this time I was reading Gabriel's very old, very delicate original edition. It was practically a religious experience. This was a vastly different library from just a year ago, when it was stuffed with my well-worn paperback versions of Jane Austen and Roald Dahl novels, and my creepily extensive collection of unicorn figurines. This was a grown-up library. I'd cleared out quite a bit of space for Gabriel's books and furniture. It wasn't a difficult choice, considering that most of his books were valuable antiques, whereas most of mine were purchased at second-hand paperback shops. I'd also packed most of my unicorn collection away in the cellar, threatening Gabriel with permanent sunburn if he so much as breathed a word about it to Dick. As Gabriel moved toward me, my pitifully hideous but lovable dog, Fitz, raised his head from my knee. Gently nudging Fitz aside, Gabriel pressed kisses along the line of my throat and announced,
"My VHS tapes now have a permanent home in your entertainment center, alphabetized and divided by genre."
At this announcement, Fitz trotted out of the room in search of some pair of Gabriel's shoes that he hadn't managed to chew yet. I peered up at him over the top of the book, cringing. "So now would be a really bad time to tell you that I don't have a VHS player anymore, right? This is a strictly digital household." Gabriel groaned and flopped down next to me.
"I'm going to have to buy Casablanca again."
"You didn't notice the lack of a VCR in the TV cabinet?" I asked. He shook his head.
"You know I don't understand half of the gadgets you have around here."
That was true. The previous week, I'd caught him trying to reboot my wireless network by kicking the router across the room. That was a long conversation. I shook my head. "How did I end up in a relationship in which I am the tech person?" He leaned in and kissed me.
"When you taught me how to work my voicemail, I knew I could never let you go."
I giggled as Gabriel crossed the room and selected an older volume from the crowded shelves. I watched him move, unabashedly love-struck. My human relationships had been few and far between, but they'd been polite, civilized, boring. I craved Gabriel with a bone-deep lust I'd once reserved exclusively for Godiva truffles. I was fixated, not just in the physical sense, although that was an obvious and occasionally distracting bonus, but also with what he thought, how he saw the world, how he saw me. It was addictive to see myself reflected in his liquid silver eyes as strong, beautiful, intelligent, and interesting, though slightly exasperating. We each provided a vital service for the other. He made me stronger, and I kept him from taking himself too seriously. Gabriel settled in next to me, absorbed in a vintage copy of Jane Eyre. We sat like that for some time, quietly reveling in not having anything to do, anywhere to be. Crisis-free moments like this had been rare in our relationship. "Jane Eyre?" I asked. "Not your usual selection." He nodded.
"You've only mentioned a dozen or so times that Edward Rochester is second only to Mr. Darcy on your fictional character free pass list. I want to know what I'm up against."
I smirked, snuggling into his side. "You stand a fair chance, as long as you don't have a crazy wife hidden away somewhere." I stared at him for a beat.
I don't, he said, shaking his head at me and opening his book. That may have seemed like an unfair shot, but Gabriel and I had suffered serious relationship issues related to his careful editing of his past. Case in point, the fire in my cellar caused by Gabriel's psycho child, Janine, who had stalked me, nearly killed me with aerosol silver, and eventually arranged for our friend Andrea to be forcibly turned into a vampire. I tried to resist pointing out that all of this could have been avoided if Gabriel had told me about Janine instead of playing the tortured, I can't tell you because you'll hate me, so I'll protect you by keeping you in the dark card. Trust me, that card never works. I ended up with more undead friends and a serious cleaning bill for smoke damage. And then, as the vampire who technically defeated her in a taser versus lunatic soaked in lamp oil battle, there was the hassle of receiving the proceeds from Janine's estate through the council, then donating them to various charities. I didn't want one penny from her crazy behind darkening my doorway. Just checking, I said, smiling sweetly and earning an undignified but amused snort from Gabriel. I returned my attention to poor, persevering Anne Elliot. Once again, I wondered how she managed to go so many chapters without bitch-slapping every single person she came into contact with. I actually wrote a paper about it in college. My professor deducted points for using the phrase bitch-slap in the title. It was totally worth it. I was just settling into the salons of Austenian Bath when Gabriel muttered, "This is strange." I looked up to see him pulling a long, blue-gray thread from between the nearly translucent pages. My jaw dropped, and I was kneeling on the chaise in a flash. "Is the binding coming loose?" "No, don't pull it. I can take it to my book doctor tomorrow night." "Stop hyperventilating, sweetheart. I think it's a bookmark," he said, pulling on the thread until he'd stretched it into my hand. "Here." I wound the thread around my finger. What passage was it marking? He scanned the page and lifted an eyebrow. "It's an Edward and Jane scene. I know how you love those." Edward saying, "I sometimes have a queer feeling with regard to you, especially when you are near me, as now. It is as if I had a string somewhere under my left ribs, tightly and inextricably knotted to a similar string situated in the corresponding quarter of your little frame." I was so caught up in watching his lips as they formed the words that I barely noticed the sudden tension on the fiber wound around my finger. I realized now that Gabriel had slipped a ring onto the thread and was sliding it toward me. I watched as the respectable diamond twinkled in the light of the oil lamp. "I'm not Edward," Gabriel promised. "I'm not afraid the thread will break and leave me bleeding. Our thread's already been tested, and it will hold up. I'm asking you to make the link permanent. Please, marry me." I smiled as the ring slid into my hand. I can't say this was a surprise. After the passing of the Federal Undead Marriage Act a few months before, Gabriel had officially proposed with this very tasteful solitaire. And I'd said no. We'd agreed to move in together because I'd told Gabriel that I wasn't ready to be engaged yet. I was still adjusting to being a vampire. I was still recovering from Zeb and Jolene's wedding from hell. And, oh yeah, Gabriel's child had just tried to murder me in my own home. I needed a breather. Gabriel had proposed again a few weeks later, and I wasn't ready. And then again on my birthday, and I still wasn't ready. Then he promised not to ask me again until I was ready. And when he'd said that, I'd suddenly felt ready. And then I'd felt like an idiot because by then, he'd stopped proposing. This was no ballpark jumbotron, no ring hidden in a souffle. It was the right way for Gabriel to ask me to marry him. And this was the right time. I nodded, mute, and the tension seemed to drain out of Gabriel. He grinned, slid his hands in my hair, and pulled me close.
"I struggled with the right passage, you know," he said, sliding the ring over my knuckle and kissing the web of skin between my fingers. "I tried all of Austin's works, but the proposals are all so formal. I thought you would appreciate Edward's passion. And it still involves a Jane, after all. The ring is a copy of my mother's. I took the stone from her engagement ring and had a jeweler place it in a titanium setting."
"Titanium?" I asked.
"Dick knew a guy," he said. Of course he did. You're a bit rough and tumble with jewelry, and I knew it would have to be able to stand up to...
Nuclear winter?
His eyebrow lifted.
I never know with you.
I laughed, throwing my arms around him and knocking him back on the seat and straddling his hips. Hovering over him, I nuzzled his neck, kissing and nipping before my fangs extended. I scraped them along his jugular, making him shudder and snake his hands around my waist, pulling me closer. I threaded my fingers through his coal-black hair and tugged his head back. His own fangs snicked out as he grinned up at me. He cupped my cheeks in his palms and gave me my first betrothed kiss. I have to say that if I'd known that was what I had to look forward to as a married woman, I probably would have agreed to the engagement a lot sooner. He chuckled, pressing his thumb over my right canine, letting it pierce the skin. I nibbled at it as he twisted under me, a sweet little trickle of my sire's blood lending to an equally wet and pleasant sensation elsewhere. Pushing the scoop neck of my blouse away, he trailed his lips over the edge of my bra and snapped the left strap with his razor-sharp fangs. Your underwear budget triples when you're dating the undead.
You haven't said yes, by the way,
he murmured, snapping the other bra strap with his teeth. I gasped, and his thumb fell away from my mouth.
I'm sorry. Yes, yes, yes. Should I find it disturbing that it took jewelry to make you cry yes, yes, yes in my presence for the first time?
He asked, nuzzling my throat. Nice, I snickered.
So, who do you want to call first?
He asked.
Your mother? Jenny? Zeb and Jolene? Oh, or I could call Dick, act like I'm sobbing and tell him you said no, make him think that he has to take me out for an evening of drinking and not talking about our feelings.
That's your idea of a joke? I asked, arching my eyebrow.
He smirked, pulling my blouse over my head. My ruined bra fell to pieces and dropped to the floor.
I find Dick squirming in the face of emotional vulnerability to be the height of hilarity.
This is why Dick wins all of your prank wars, I told him. As he pulled me back onto the chaise, my weight settled on his chest.
Do you want to call your mother first, or Zeb?
I shook my head, cradling my face into his neck. No.
No?
Neither. First, because I'd like to wait until I can tell Aunt Jetty. I sighed, thinking fondly of my ghostly great-aunt and her equally deceased beau, Gilbert Wainwright. And I don't know when she'll be back from whatever astral jaunt she and Mr. Wainwright are taking. And second, because I want to lie here with you and enjoy being engaged without being squealed at or hug-strangled or told that I don't want to get married in the spring because it's impossible to get the right mix of seasonal tulips. I just want to...
I sighed and rubbed my bare chest against his shirt in a distinctly non-virginal bride manner.
Bask.
You never do what I expect you to, he said, kissing the ring on my finger.
Admit it. That's part of the attraction.
Yes. Yes, it is.
He sighed.
But you will be the one to tell your mother, right? I asked your father for his blessing, but I think you should be the one to deliver the news to your mother.
I snorted. Mama's reaction to our premarital cohabiting included screaming and yelling and threatening us with grounding. Considering that the worst that his own mother had ever done to him was call for her smelling salts, Gabriel was permanently scarred. He had flashbacks for weeks.
So, I'm thinking Vegas Strip next Friday.
We could gamble a little, get married, bail Dick out of jail, and be home by Monday, I suggested.
We are not going to get married in some dingy chapel by an Elvis impersonator.
We could get a Streisand impersonator if it would make you feel more comfortable.
Jane, he chuckled, exasperated. Is that really how you want to get married? Skulking off like we're ashamed of ourselves? Was that what little Jane dreamed and hoped for?
Little Jane thought she would marry Mark Paul Gosselaar from Saved by the Bell in an English castle. Little Jane was an idiot.
If you want the English castle, you shall have it. Minus this Mark Paul person, he said. And if you really want the Vegas Strip, you shall have that. I want you to have the sort of wedding that will make you happy.
I countered. What about the kind of wedding that makes you happy?
I want to show up in a tux and be told where to stand. That would make me very happy.
I groaned.
What about wedding planning scares you?
All of it. Picking out flowers, the dress, the bridesmaid dresses. No, wait, I'm looking forward to that. Vengeance will be mine. But making all the choices, and then having those choices subtly criticized by every woman in my family, and the fact that each of those choices will probably ruin the wedding for someone. Ruin the wedding. When my sister wanted to get married at the country club, Grandma Ruthie said the wedding would be ruined for her if Jenny got married anywhere but the Baptist church. Several cousins threatened to boycott if Jenny didn't allow children to attend. Our great uncle said he wouldn't come to the reception unless you served Pabst Blue Ribbon. People just seem to lose their minds when it comes to weddings. You can't make everybody happy.
So we won't try, Gabriel said. We'll do what makes us happy. It's our wedding, after all.
I chuckled, pressing my lips to his throat, the curve of his jaw, as I rolled over him and slipped my fingers around his belt buckle, sliding it open.
Oh, you're so naive.
It's cute, really. We stayed in that happy, naked, secret engagement bubble until I had to open the shop the next evening. Things had been progressing very nicely at Specialty Books since I'd reopened earlier that year. While we initially depended on special efforts such as the Bump in the Night book club and meetings of the local chapter of the Friends and Family of the Undead to keep in the black, online sales and increasingly healthy in-store traffic made opening the electric bills and supplier invoices a lot less painful every month. There were times when I felt like a failure for never leaving the Hollow. I mean, I lived just a few miles from the house where I'd grown up. But there were good reasons for me to stay when I was human. My family, Aunt Jetty, the Half Moon Hollow Public Library, where I'd devoted most of my adult years to helping kids find books to love. And if I'd left, I might never have met Gabriel. I would probably still be human. And clearly, this was the life I'd been intended for. Big city life, babies, and aging just weren't my style. Still, Half Moon Hollow is a strange place for a vampire to spend her days. The small town stereotype in which everybody knows everybody, or is at least related to them by marriage, holds true in a lot of places, such as the Hollow. Newspapers and telephones are kept around for convenience, but the real flow of information runs through the kitchens, beauty parlors, and grocery aisles. A visit to town on Saturday morning means the difference between community ignorance and knowing who's in jail, who's knocked up, and whose marriage is teetering on the brink of disaster. As one of the few out vampires living in the Hollow, I was still occasionally the subject of gossip. My neighbors seemed torn between fearing me and remembering me as the goofy band geek who'd babysat their children. You could see it in their eyes sometimes, the initial rush of familiarity and affection, just before they remembered that I was no longer that girl, no longer human. The light in their eyes quickly extinguished, and the outstretched arms that had meant to hug me were extended into a timid handshake. If I was lucky. But I'd made enough friends in the supernatural community to make up for it. Friends like Andrea and Dick, who'd already arrived at the shop by the time I opened the door. But, considering the noises I heard from the storeroom, I decided to give them a few minutes. Seriously, I once walked into the office without knocking. I was scarred for life. And I'm going to live forever. I sorted through that day's mail, shelved some newly arrived selections, and replenished the sweeteners in the coffee bar. I fired up the cappuccino machine and found that we were out of 2%, which meant that my mochaccino had a little less chino. I improvised with a little faux type O and prayed that Andrea wouldn't hear me messing with her baby.
Jane?
No such luck. Andrea came rushing into the room, straightening her must-titian hair. I cringed. The last time she'd found me turning on the cappuccino maker, she'd thrown a Mayan quartz skull at my head, which, if you think about it, is sort of in poor taste.
Remember? I am your boss,
I said, raising my hands and my bloody chino in a defensive position.
What the hell is that?
Andrea demanded, pointing at my hands. Even in her angry, rumpled state, Andrea was one of the most poised and elegant women I knew. I often said she was what Grace Kelly would have looked like if Grace had reddish hair and a propensity for dating redneck scoundrels. And I was going to put her in the ugliest bridesmaid dress I could find. Look, I get it. I'm not as good at running the machine as you are.
There's no reason to be all snotty about it. Are you going after a raise or something?
Not the coffee, you ninny. The rock on your left hand.
Did Gabriel finally break you down and convince you to say yes? Did you just call me a ninny? What are you, 70? She huffed, a tendril of her deep red hair fluttering in her face.
Don't ignore the question.
Yes, okay? I said yes. We're getting married. I prepared for squealing and a girly-girly bonding moment. Instead, she yelled, Dick! I owe you $5. I heard a loud whoop from the back room as Andrea hugged me.
You know, you should be a little more considerate of my standing wagers when you make major life decisions.
You made a bet on whether I would agree to marry Gabriel? I exclaimed, slapping her shoulder. And you only bet $5? Dick walked in and grinned evilly at the sight of us hugging and talking practically nose to nose.
Dear penthouse, I never believed something like this could happen to me, but when my super-hot wife asked me what I wanted more than anything else for my birthday...
Andrea sighed and dropped her head to my shoulder in defeat. Hey, you married him.
I have no one to blame but myself, she muttered as Dick left to rummage around in the storeroom.
A mind-boggling mix of fierce loyalty and moral flexibility, Dick used to be the local go-to guy for under-the-table commerce. If you needed an iPod that would only work on European adapters, he was your guy. He lived this way for more than a century before he fell hard for Andrea, the first woman actually to turn him down in all that time. Andrea didn't find any of Dick's roguish ways remotely charming, which apparently was what he was looking for all along. He managed to make the leap from dating to cohabiting by slowly but surely moving his vaguely obscene T-shirts and Dukes of Hazzard memorabilia into her swanky townhouse condo. It was by far the sneakiest thing I'd ever seen him do. And that's saying something.
Tell her about the other part of the bet,
Dick snickered as he reemerged, carrying a bottle of champagne and 3 glasses. How do you always happen to have champagne handy for special occasions? I asked.
I hide it in your break room fridge, he said, popping the cork and pouring generous splashes into each of our glasses,
mixing it with synthetic blood for a disturbing mimosa.
None of your employees eats, so it's a safe spot. Now, my dearest wife, tell our Jane the other part of the bet. I'll even help you start off.
If Jane said yes to Gabriel before March Madness, you owed me $5, and...
Andrea sighed.
And you get to decorate the den with your Dukes of Hazzard memorabilia.
I winced at the burn of champagne bubbles being channeled up my nose. Dick and Andrea had been battling over the renovations to Dick's family home ever since Gabriel had given the deed back to Dick months before. Gabriel hadn't left the house to rot while it was under his care for the last century or so, but he hadn't exactly kept it move-in ready either. Using every illicit contact at his disposal, Dick was gathering the manpower and materials to completely modernize the place. Indoor plumbing, electrical wiring, lightproofing the bedroom, and adding a shower big enough for 8 to the master bath. I chose not to think about why they might need a shower that big. Having just overseen the completion of his own home, my human best friend, Zeb, was helping Dick with some of the work. Andrea sat back and prayed that their version of rewiring wouldn't burn the house down while they slept for the day. Other than occasionally suggesting a wall color or picking out tile, Andrea had left the renovations to Dick. Until he showed her his decorating plans for the den, apparently.
And this means it's no longer a den, Dick said, nudging her. It's now a
man cave, she said, wrinkling up her face as if saying the words pained her.
I covered my giggles with another sip of the bubbly. Dick put his arm around my shoulders.
Here's looking at you, Stretch. If Gabriel doesn't make you deliriously happy, I'll kick his ass.
Be sure to include that in your toast at the wedding, I chuckled.
Oh, my gosh, the wedding, Andrea squealed. When is it? Where will it be? What about your dress?
I groaned. Andrea considered herself to be the authority on undead matrimony.
She and Dick were the first vampire couple to marry legally in McClure County. There'd been an outdoor nighttime ceremony, the first party Gabriel had hosted at his home in more than 100 years, and the last one he hosted before officially handing the keys to my sister, Jenny.
His gift served two purposes. Soothing Jenny's chronically tender feelings after being denied our ancestral home, River Oaks, and giving me a good reason to invite Gabriel to come live with me.
Andrea had worn a vintage confection she'd found online. I'd barely managed to talk Dick out of wearing his tuxedo T-shirt, for which I'd been rewarded by not having to wear another damned bridesmaid dress. And now, thanks to her acquired expertise, Andrea was going to give Mama a run for her money in terms of annoying me. Well, Gabriel shot down my Vegas plan, so I haven't a clue, I said.
You mean he had a woman offer to skip all the wedding crap and marry him in Vegas and he turned it down? I need to talk some sense into that boy, Dick said, shaking his head.
When Andrea glared at him, he quickly added,
Not that I didn't absolutely love all of our wedding crap, baby. Happiest day of my life, really.
Andrea sniffed and turned on her heel toward the ritual candle section.
I snickered and taunted Dick. So much trouble.
Shut it, you,
he grumbled before pitching his voice into an apologetic whine.
Andrea, baby, I didn't mean it like that.
Realizing that I'd left my cell phone in Big Bertha, my trusty weathered station wagon, I made my way out of the shop with a little skip in my step and a tune on my lips.
Dick had managed to distract Andrea from her, our wedding was special, tirade with more good news. After reviewing last quarter's sales, he'd found that Specialty Books was actually showing a profit for the first time since my former boss, Mr. Wainwright, opened it 60 years before. Even with the stuff destroyed when his nephew Emery repeatedly broke into the shop, we were ahead of our projections for the quarter. Most of the increase was rooted in online sales, a result of Zeb's redesigning the shop's website. And yes, I was letting Dick handle the bookkeeping. It turns out that ruthlessly calculating profits from underhanded back-alley deals actually makes one pretty good with math. And now that I knew where he slept on a permanent basis, I trusted him not to steal from me. I danced around the front of my decades-old Ford station wagon and saw that Jamie Lanier, our dairy delivery guy, was pulling up to the curb in his half-moon dairy truck. I smiled and waved as I opened my driver's side door.
Hey, Miss Jane,
he hollered over the blaring of his earbuds as he unloaded his hand truck. I cringed at his use of Miss, which clearly indicated that Jamie still thought of me as the old lady who used to babysit him every summer.
Again, I say, this is the drawback of living in your hometown.
Local hunks have to start off somewhere, and generally, it's as the kid who would only eat smiley face pancakes from ages 5 to 7. And good Lord, Jamie was a hunk. He had the all-American apple pie look that they probably used as a template when they made G.I. Joe dolls. And the color palette wasn't bad either. Warm, tanned skin and olive green eyes that twinkled at me from under the fringe of his wavy, dark blonde hair. He loomed 4 inches over even my tall frame, and I found myself stammering and blushing like a schoolgirl every time he stood less than an arm's length from me. Did I mention that he was just about to graduate from high school? Which would make me the dirtiest old lady in the world. Andrea enjoyed my discomfort each week when Jamie delivered dairy products for the coffee bar, which again made me question the value of having girlfriends. I leaned into my car, searching for the charger cord that tethered my phone. Honestly, it was the only way I could find the damn thing most days. My head cocked toward the sound of tires screeching. I straightened up to see an old, rusted-out black sedan with dark-tinted windows barreling down the street, heading straight for Jamie's truck. Backing out of the rear gate, his hand truck loaded with crates, Jamie had no clue that he was walking right into the path of the oncoming car. Jamie! I screamed. Jamie froze and whipped around just as the car struck him. The force of the chrome bumper striking his knees slammed him to the pavement. Jamie barely let out a yelp as his head made a sick, cracking noise against the pavement. I screamed again at the wet thump of the tires rolling over his torso, the snap of breaking ribs.
We hope you enjoyed this free preview of Nice Girls Don't Bite Their Neighbors, Book 4 in the Jane Jameson series. To keep the story going, get the complete book today.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.